welcome to this wonderful occasion when Georgetown Federal Society honors people for their lifetime service to the cause of liberty, justice, and the rule of law. The Georgetown Federal Society engages conservatives and libertarians in the campus dialogue by hosting speakers, debates, panels, and social events. The Society was founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province of the duty and the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what it should be. Today, the Georgetown Federal Society is presenting Richard Epstein with its annual Lifetime Service Award to individuals who have made a significant contribution to the realization of these principles. And as ACA will tell you, I substantially rearranged my travel schedule so that I could be here today to make the welcome of Richard Epstein, and I want to tell you why. Because I am one of Richard Epstein's achievements. For better or for worse. When I was a third-year law student, I organized a conference at Harvard Law School on criminal justice theory. And one of my heroes, who I'd never met, was a fellow from the University of Chicago Law School who had written a series of articles on strict liability in tort law, and which actually explained tort law in a way to me that my professor had not. In fact, his a description of strict liability in tort law bore no relation to the theory of strict liability. My professor was no slouch, Charles Freed, but somehow I found that I hadn't learned torts until I read Richard's articles. And when I put this conference together on criminal justice theory, I used it as an excuse to invite Richard to write about criminal justice theory for the first time in his career. In those days, I mean, now you all know Richard as a polymath, is that what you call it, where he writes about everything? But in those days, he really had just gotten started, and he was primarily a tort scholar, and so this was his first opportunity to write about criminal justice. And it was a really big conference, and a lot of fancy people there, and it produced the first book that I had called Assessing the Criminal. But the highlight for me was the opportunity I had to ride on the bus from the Copley Plaza Hotel to the Harvard Law School. We had to put everybody up in the Copley Plaza Hotel because there were no decent hotels in Cambridge at the time. And I got to ride next to Richard Epstein as a third-year law student to and from the conference. Wouldn't be quite as big a thrill today as it was then, but I can tell you something. It was an enormous that was a dig. Yes, it was. but it was an enormous thrill. Then. So that was my first introduction to Richard Epstein, and which I really went to great lengths to try to make happen, so I got to meet him. The second thing, which was every bit as big as the first, was after I was a criminal prosecutor in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, I went into the teaching market, the AALS teaching market, to try to get a teaching job, and went through the teaching market, and I think I had about 7 interviews and no callbacks, and I got no job. So what to do? And what to do was to go to the University of Chicago as a research fellow, and that was made possible by the fact that Richard sponsored me at the law school with the dean, Jeff Stone, at the time, and prevailed upon him to basically create a fellowship position that didn't exist called a research fellow. And that gave me the opportunity to be at the University of Chicago Law School. And when I went back into the teaching market, having done nothing else other than what I'd previously done, I hadn't started on my research yet. The only thing that changed was my affiliation. I was no longer a Cook County State's Attorney, but now I was a research fellow at the University of Chicago Law School. As a result, I had about 25 interviews. I'm not sure, I don't remember how many callbacks, 3 job offers, and I actually got into academia. That would not have happened if I had not changed my affiliation from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to the University of Chicago, and that would not have happened if it hadn't been for Richard Epstein. And finally, I had to decide what I was going to research at the University of Chicago Law School, and all my interest up until this point in my legal career had been criminal justice. I'd written about criminal justice. I practiced criminal justice. It was the reason I went to law school, because of criminal justice, and I had to decide what I was going to do, and I was sort of bored with criminal justice theory a little bit, and I wanted to do something completely different, and so I decided to be a contracts professor, because my aspiration was to do for contract law theory what Richard had done for tort law theory. So in that sense, he was an inspiration substantively, as well as facilitating my entry to my legal career, and then the rest, as you know, is history. So if I could be considered an achievement, My career could be considered an achievement, and my career could have been considered as a contribution to the cause of liberty, justice, the Constitution, and the rule of law, then Richard Epstein made that career possible. And that's the reason why I came here tonight, to welcome him and as well as to welcome you to this event. And now, to tell us all about his career and why it's so special and why it was so inspiring to me and generations of students is my colleague, Nick Rosenkranz.
That was great. Thanks, Randy. I am delighted to be here. I'm always happy to talk to the Federalist Society, talk at Federalist Society events. I am, as you know, the faculty advisor to the Georgetown chapter here. I also serve on the Board of Visitors. It's a particular honor for me to welcome Richard Epstein and be and introduce him at the occasion of this Lifetime Achievement Award. I too count myself as an achievement of Richard Epstein's, and the effect that Richard Epstein had on me was even earlier in my career. So before I had even decided to be a lawyer, I graduated from Yale undergrad in 1992, and I went to New York and I did theater for years. I was directing plays, I was working at the Atlantic Theater Company and whatnot. And then in the summer of 1995, and I unfortunately don't have the date, I was reading the New York Times and I came upon this book review, the New York Times 1995 summer, and it's a review of Richard Epstein's Simple Rules for a Complex World. And I had never heard of Richard Epstein and I had never heard of this book or any of these ideas. But something about this book review seemed incredibly intriguing to me. The reviewer clearly wanted to dismiss the book out of hand, clearly wanted to dismiss Richard as some sort of crank, and couldn't do it, just couldn't do it. So we get, even in the first paragraph here, Richard Epstein, a professor of law at the University of Chicago, has a record of proposing radical and extreme alterations in key areas of law, alterations that perhaps initially could be dismissed as so far from the center of legal thinking as to be of only theoretical interest, but then turn out to have much more political life in them than one could have thought possible. And the review goes on in that vein. At the end, we read, it is bracing to undergo a cold bath in the pure doctrine of the simple rules, and in many areas they will give us practical guidance. This reviewer wanted to hate this book and couldn't manage to hate it. It was so intellectually powerful and intellectually honest. I read this review, then I went out and bought the book. I read the book, and then I decided to apply to law school. And so I literally would not be here today but for this review and this book, true story. I don't believe, Richard, I've ever told you that story, but it is a true story. I'm going to tell just one more Richard Epstein anecdote, and then I'm going to give you the man himself. So then I went to Yale Law School and got involved with the Federalist Society as a student, and we invited Richard to come and speak. And of course, this was a particular thrill for me in light of the prior story. So we invited him to speak, and we were delighted that he accepted. And it occurred to us after he accepted that it would be perhaps even a better event if we could arrange it as a debate. So the Federalist Society, debate is a central core tenet of the Federalist Society, that ideas are examined via vigorous debate with zealous advocates on both sides. And so Federalist Society, to the extent possible, is always keen to organize debates rather than mere speeches. And we decided, wouldn't it be great if we could have Richard Epstein debate? unfortunately, true then as it is now, it was often hard to persuade speakers to come and debate. It's much easier to give a speech than to debate. It's much easier, and particularly at Yale, the Yale Law School faculty, a little bit intimidating to some people. Many people much rather just get up and talk about their scholarship than actually really have to engage with someone. And so we knew it was kind of a long shot. We thought it was kind of a long shot, but we called Richard Epstein and we said, well, you know, would you maybe consider doing this event as a debate with one of the Yale professors? And he gave what I now know to be the classic Richard Epstein answer to this particular inquiry, which was, quote, I will debate anyone at any time on any topic. I actually thought surely that must be an idle boast, but I have subsequently had the opportunity to hear Richard Epstein debate an enormous variety of speakers on an enormous variety of topics, and I have yet to see him lose one of these debates. With that, Richard Epstein.
Actually, now I don't even know whether I should give my prepared speech. I do want to comment on the two things that were done, and let me see. With Randy, I have to make one correction. Jeff Stone wasn't dean at that time. You were there, what about, it was Gerhard Casper, I think, that was the dean. And then Jeff was his successor, but we forgive you that error. And I have to tell you, Randy sat in on my torts class when I did that. He sat on the right and the lower time, right? And I still remember he would come up after every session and either critique me or explain to me what it was that he had learned. And then there was one day, I remember I was too close to some woman, and he says, you almost went over the line. And do you remember saying that to me? Well, you did. And so I had to basically pull my hands back to myself. So not only was he a constant guide in the classroom, but he served as a moral tutor, for which I am extremely grateful. And with respect to Nick, I do want to tell you a little bit of the backstory about that review. There are two features about it. One, you didn't mention whom it was written by. I believe it was Nathan Glazer. Nathan Glazer was a neocon, which meant that he was an ex-liberal who could never quite get over the guilt that he had for not wanting to share the wealth. He was also a very close friend of Daniel Bell, who was my mentor when I was at Columbia College, with whom I had taken many courses. He had always been enormously supportive of me, but thought that my incorrigible libertarian tendencies were definitely the sign of an intellectual death knell. Even now, at 91 years old, he sort of looks at me whenever I see him, which is not very often, with a slight disapproving air as to why it was I didn't become more time. So I think in part he wrote it that way because he actually knew the connections to me through this other sorts of person. And the other story about it, this was a great tribute to the Harvard University Press. They knew that this was going to be the lead review, if I'm not mistaken, it was on page 3 or some such thing, I think, but very close to the beginning. What, it is page 3? Okay. And you know, they had this a month in advance, and unlike most reviews, you were not the only one, Nick, who thought that it would be appropriate to get it. And of course, they ran out of copies the day after the thing came out. And so I called Michael Aronson, who's still a friend, and I said, why on earth is this triumph of planning? And then I quoted him from Bob Bork's famous line, which I thoroughly endorse, which he says, the only industry in the world that makes you pine for socialism is the publishing business, right? Because they couldn't figure out what anticipated demands would start to be. Since that time, the New York Times has a better approach with respect to book reviews. Either they plant it in somebody who's sure to be hostile, or even better, they just ignore everything you write. Because, I mean, it's gotten to the point where they don't even want to give a forum to ideas which to some extent are disagreeable with them. If you don't believe this, I suggest you take a look at the April 17th, 2005 issue with Jeff Rosen's effort to be nice with a picture which comes straight from Dracula when they did a study on myself. And Mike Grieve, I think, was also in that, and Chip Melder, whom I don't see here, was the third villain of the particular piece. Now, I'm supposed to talk about stuff, and I'm in Washington, and so what I did is I steeled myself in the following fashion, with a stout and permanent resolution not to talk about anything, at least apparently, that deals with current politics. So the title that I chose for this particular talk had something to do with, I can't remember the title, but it had something to do with natural law, both ancient and modern, I think is close enough. And the question is, why would I want to teach this? And since everybody else has been autobiographical, let me be at least a little autobiographical myself and sort of indicate to you one of the great calamities which turned into one of the great triumphs of my life. I did not start law school in the United States. I had won a scholarship from Columbia College, and I'd gone off to Oriel College, and I decided that I was going to study English law in a very self-conscious judgment that knowing a little bit about two systems would be better than knowing only things about one of them. And so I thought if I knew the English side and the American side, it would kind of help. And then by the luck of the draw, it turned out that I was at Oriel College, and the tutor was a man named Alan Watson, who is a bona fide antiquarian, and his expertise was in Roman law. So unlike studying, you know, Marbury and Madison the first day of law school, the first text that I ever read in law school was Gaius 388, and it says, now we shall transfer to contracts. And so I essentially did the Roman law of contracts for my first quarter of law school, and it was the only thing that I did. And since that time, I actually got hooked. And one of the reasons why I regard this as a great fortune is that a subject which to all of you would seem to be mightily irrelevant to the way in which you think about the modern world essentially became the first exposure that I had to the world. And I have to tell you that I became implicitly some kind of a Romanist. I know this sounds very strange because I don't mean this in any sort of Roman Catholic type sense. It's just that I got kind of seduced by what I thought to be the eerie sort of formal rigor and great intuitive common sense associated with Roman law. I have taught the subject in American law schools now since 1973, most recently on Monday morning. And in some sense, what I'm going to do on Monday afternoon is here is to kind of tell you the way in which that experience as being a Roman law professor has essentially shaped my life. In order to do that, I have to sort of hit back on a theme that Nick said, that on the sort of any time, any topic, any subject, whatever it was. That's not only my philosophy with respect to debates, it's also been my philosophy with respect to teaching, which is I sort of, the dean asked me what I want to teach, and I asked, what would you like me to teach? And then we finally negotiate, and I get a little upset if I have to teach same thing too many times in a row. But Roman law is one that's been pretty much a steady. And what happens is when you teach this particular way, what you do is, I think, develop the single most important virtue that you could have as a modern academic, and I only mean this half in jest, which is superficiality. What you have to do when you work with respect to legal stuff is to avoid the paradigm which will kill the next generation of scholars in law schools, which is to be a mile deep and an inch wide, so that you know everything about something, and after a while that something turns out to be nothing, so you don't know very much at all. What you have to be prepared to do is to kind of see the way in which broad themes integrate with respect to subject matter. And as I started to think about this over the years, with Roman law as being essentially one of my linchpins, I decided that the only effective way to understand legal theory was to have something which comported with all of the essential virtues that one could think of in a desirable theory. You wanted to have a theory which was old. You wanted to have some kind of an approach to a subject which was able to last and to be expanded in two dimensions. You'd like it to move to some extent across cultures, and you'd like it to move to some extent across time, so that the kind of provinciality that's associated with much of modern American law would not be part of your general sort of jurisprudence. In addition to that, you would like it to sort of respect tradition on the one hand, but bring to it a kind of intellectual rigor which depends upon every one of the modern intellectual developments which takes place outside the law, which you could use to understand those things which occur inside the law. And so since I was a kind of a general pack rat to begin with as an undergraduate, choosing never to major in a particular subject, when I found out that I could minor in three of them and get away with that, what happens is you'd like to be able to bring mathematics to bear on this stuff. You'd like to bring linguistics to bear on this stuff. You'd like to be able to bring evolutionary biology to bear on this stuff. Knowing a little bit about game theory would never hurt you. Knowing something about history, knowing something about economic theory, whatever it was that you could find to learn was something that you wanted to incorporate. The basic sort of view that I have of the way in which intellectual scholarship should work is that you want to make sure that if there's any discipline which seems to have any relationship to anything that you want to do, you want to be part of it. And that's always been the way in which I've tried to do this. But the question is, where do you start with this particular inquiry? And essentially, I started with the beginning of Roman law. If you go back and you look at both Justinian's which is the sort of classic institutes, and a book by a man named Gaius, who wrote some 350 years before Trebonian put together the institutes, they both begin with a discussion of the importance of natural law in the legal firmament. And within a very short space, mainly no more than two or three lines, essentially what they do is they hit upon three of the major themes, which turn out to be essential in the way in which natural law theory has slowly been able to migrate forward to become a much more complicated sort of body of law today than it was at the time, simply because we have a more complicated society today than we had going earlier on. I did write a paper once called The Roman Law of Cyber Conversion, which sort of indicates to you that I think that there's nothing old which you want to forget when you're trying to do something new. And so you look at these three themes, and what are they? Well, the first one is there's clearly an evolutionary theme which is intended to show that the way in which you understand human behavior is not to isolate it from the way in which you understand the behavior that takes place by ordinary animals under other circumstances. So essentially, natural law was put in their phrase as something which is written in the heart of all species, including human beings. And, you know, to some extent, when you start thinking about that, anybody who wants to sort of talk about a system of natural law as applying not only to people, but also to animals, to pigs, to ducks, or to whatever it is, may in fact appear to you to be certifiably insane. But in fact, it's exactly the right set of impulses when you do it, because the first thing that this requires you to do is to ask what it is that animals and people have in common, notwithstanding the fact that in matters of speech and intellect, they have a great deal that separates them. And it turns out that a lot of the basic desires that animate human beings come from evolutionary pressures that long antedate the creation of human beings, and that suggests to you that they're going to be much more immovable and indelible than you might have otherwise thought. So that when somebody starts to think about what human beings are like and what natural law is, you come up with the right instinct, not the wrong instinct, which is there's something deeply embedded in individual personality that any legal system is going to have to take into account, instead of looking at everybody around this room and saying that really all you are is a social construction of somebody's influences, one way or another, infinitely malleable and infinitely changed. And I think that once you understand those things, then the question is, what is it about these people that you discover which turns out to have that form of indelibility? And let me just mention a couple of these things. One of them is, of course, a very sophisticated version of what we sometimes call self-interest. And in this particular case, if you start with the biology, you don't mean individual self-interest. You mean self-interest with respect to some larger group, a family, a clan, or a tribe, and so forth. When you try to figure out what that means, is it says that at least within these groups, there's a kind of a strong interdependence such that you can depend upon goodwill of one form or another for them to take care of each other. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a mother and her child on the one hand or a lion and her cub on the other. What you do is you understand what they always told you in Africa, don't stand between a hippopotamus and its calf because it will just run you over by virtue of the fact of these natural impulses. And so once you realize that people have them and that you realize that they only run within the family, what you start to do is to develop one of the central distinctions that exist with respect to all forms of legal systems. And that's the distinction between arm's length transactions on the one hand with strangers and familial transactions on the other hand. And those arm's length transactions should be understood, as you discover linguistically, always literally. You're keeping somebody at arm's length, and there's only one reason why you're doing that. You don't trust them. And if you keep them at arm's length, they can't stab you. One of the reasons you shake hands is to prove that your business hand, most people it's the right hand, doesn't contain a concealed weapon and so forth. And you realize, therefore, that you're going to need two kinds of relationships in order to organize the world simply by starting with that result. And the second thing that you start to realize about this is, again, the willingness to be completely accepting of the complexity associated with mental states. One of the modern curses of legal systems is to sort of say that it's only the objective that matters. States of mind really don't count at all. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was wrong on many things, was also wrong on this one when he started to talk about the relationship between tort and crime. But anybody who's ever studied animals will start to tell you an animal knows when it's provoked, an animal knows when it's an aggressor. An animal knows when it's defending its own kind. And what you realize by doing this is that the things that drive you are not cognitively significant. They're basically built into the deep part of the brain, which explains why it is that they're going to be so difficult to move and so difficult to change. And therefore, if you get this architecture right, all of a sudden you could upgrade it by talking about the difference between relational contracts and spot contracts, and you can start to figure out how you evaluate these things, because all of this essentially anticipates Hamilton's famous contributions about inclusive fitness, which were only formalized on the way in which the precise mathematical relationships within family in the Journal of Theoretical Biology in 1964. So it's a kind of a very nice way in which once you understand what the modern stuff is doing, you go back and you look at the ancient stuff, and their intuitions were pretty good, even though their formalization with respect to this was not very strong. And that's paragraph one. In paragraph two, you find two other elements with respect to natural law, both of which, again, have an enormous influence on everybody's, on the evolution of the subject and on my thinking about it. And the first of these is when you're told that something is natural law, what you mean by that particular expression is that it's a part of the law which is common to all people in all places throughout the world. And one of the things, of course, that some of the modern anthropologists do is to take exactly the opposite position and to say that if you really want to understand the way in which legal systems work, what you have to do is to be deeply sensitive to the variations that exist between them and not to be misled by the fact that there may be one or two kinds of common element. I think, in effect, that Gaius had it exactly right when he said this, because what happens is if you start to look across various kinds of cultures, what you do is you discover that there are certain kinds of features which are, in fact, very indelible and very common. And then, as he said elsewhere in that book, same paragraph, in fact, there are other kinds of situations which are subject to variation by the law of particular jurisdictions. So the students always says, what's giving here? If the statutes could always trump the common law rules, if natural law is always beaten by statute, why do you even bother to talk about it? You should become some kind of a, to use the modern term, positivist, in which whatever is decreed by the state trumps whatever is done under natural law. And you look at Gaius, and it's quite clear that he and Justinian both understand that this is a grim political reality, but what they refuse to do is to yield to the next conclusion that whatever has to be the case in terms of the structure of the Roman Empire also has to be the case as a normative matter. And so what you then try to do is to figure out how it is that you can partition the world between those things which in fact are universal across custom and those things which in fact are distinctive with respect to the local system, recognizing all the time, as our friend Justinian said, quod principi placuit, legis vigorum habet, that which is pleasing unto the prince hath the force of law, which is essentially, if you think about it, a direct attack on whatever it is that the rule of law is right down here on the microphone. So there's this constant tension between the natural law stuff and the sort of authoritarian stuff. How did Gaius and Justinian try to resolve this? Well, essentially what they wanted to say is that there are basically three fundamental categories dealing with human experience, and then there are, in some of these cases, a set of formalities that can vary from locale to locale. So you then look at the Roman system, and actually three or four, and what you do is you start out with a discussion on the Roman law of persons, and that's actually the most discouraging part of the entire system, because what you do is you see in Justinian the proposition that all men by nature are born free, and then you recognize, but in some cases they're in chains because slavery is in fact a positive institution. And what you discover very quickly is it was such a positive institution that no jurist could simply overthrow it. And it was probably something of an act of courage on the part of the jurist to say, we know it happens and we know it's wrong. And in fact, it's the know it's wrong stuff which is most powerful from the normative point of view. And if you push that just a little bit further, you now understand what becomes much more apparent when you start doing the later British empiricists, that principles of individual ownership or individual self-rule, I'm not going to worry about the nuances between them, are in fact an essential portion of the way in which any legal system is to operate. And sure enough, if you take this notion of autonomy as meaning not that everybody owes you a living, but rather that you are entitled to be free of the interference by force and fraud of other individuals, you now see in some of this early stuff in Justinian the origins of modern libertarian and classical liberal thought. The autonomy of the person is something, in fact, which is the first and key element of the system. Now, how do you acquire that is very interesting, because the only way you can describe it is by nature. And what they meant by that is not that you went out and did some kind of ritual and so forth, but they just simply treated that posit That proposition is one which was so necessarily true that you should not be in a position to deny it. And so you could start to see in some of these early natural lawyer stuff a cross between necessary truths on the one hand and empirical truths on the other, and they never could quite figure out which of these two particular elements they thought more important. And in fact, the phrase natural law is not the Roman phrase. The correct translation is it's the reason of nature rather than natural law, because in addition to commonality as being one of the sources of liability or responsibility and entitlement, they also had kind of this natural necessity based upon the internal coherence with respect to doctrine. Now, when you want to play this out, one of the things that you discover when you read these Roman texts carefully is that at every time there's a critical move inside the system, the word natural right or natural law or law of reason, one or another of these variations comes back. And there's a very strong reason why they're doing this, because they have extremely strong awareness of the way in which the system as a whole is put together, and they understand where all the pressure points are. And rather than being able to spell out coherent and systematic justifications for what happens, what they do in effect is they always throw in a by nature or by natural reason or by common consent to do it. And what they're trying to do is essentially to cover both bases. If it's done commonly, then in effect what you do is you have durability and universality as a test of what's going on, and that in the libertarian tradition tends to lead you into the Hayekian description of the way in which things work through self-evolution. And if you start putting the by reason of nature and so forth, now it's the kind of necessary truth side, which is associated with a very diverse group of people ranging from Murray Rothbard today to Leo Strauss, who's not necessarily a libertarian, but the same idea of imminent necessity as being the driving force with respect to natural law. Well, how does it then play out? Well, you start looking at some of the cardinal distinctions, and you can see exactly the way in which the system works. And the first of them, which begins in Justinian at the beginning of Book 2, is the distinction between private and common property. And he says, in effect, that certain kinds of property by nature are necessarily held in common. And others, he said, in effect, are res nullius, which means the thing owned by no one, which can be subject to occupation, so it becomes a thing owned by someone. And then the key feature is to ask, what's the distinction that he puts between them? And sure enough, he gets it right. On the common side, you have rivers, you have the ocean, you have the beach, and you have the air. And on the private side, that is things capable of private ownership, you have land, you have chattels, or, you know, various kinds of movable things, and you have animals. So the Romans are terrific on this classification. And then you ask yourself, well, is this just simply arbitrary? Because after all, there's no formal justification when all you're doing is appealing to this kind of natural law language without any explicit justificatory strategy. And the answer is no, it's not arbitrary. And there are two ways in which you should be able to demonstrate this. The first of these ways is just sort of flip it over and see the way in which you think that the world is going to look. So what you do is you say, by nature, it turns out that those things which are subject to private ownership are the beach, the waters, and the air. And the thing which you have to remain necessarily collective are going to be land and animals and movables, right? And then ask yourself, what kind of a world are you going to have if you just simply reverse the characterization? Well, it's going to be a terrific world. If land is held in common, you'll never get it cleared and you'll never get any agriculture, which is why it was that when Blackstone talked about the justifications for private property, he starts to put it in slightly more consequential, so utilitarian terms, when he says, in effect, there's nobody who is going to sow unless he's able to reap. And the fancy economic version which comes out of that is, in effect, that unless you can internalize the future gains from productive activities, there'll be a huge agency cost problem and you'll never undertake the activity in the first place. All of these guys are barking up exactly the same tree. And what the modernists do is they take the old classification and what they explain is why it's correct. They are not doing something to explain why it is that they got it absolutely backwards and daffy. And then when you look at the common side, what's happening is you now discover that basically property has two kinds of fundamental things, and I call this a new branch of law called law and geometry. And essentially this is the way it works. Well, no matter what kind of system you take, and it starts with the biological, you always have two kinds of structures. You've got square ones, or cubic ones, essentially for which you have production, and then you have long and skinny ones, which you use with respect to collection. And remember, we started with a bunch of biological sort of situations, and if you're trying to figure out how the body works, essentially you have solid organs like the liver and the pancreas and the lungs, and then you have two long and skinny systems that link them together, one for circulation and the other for neurological connections. It's exactly the same way when you try to organize another system. And so what happens is, when you try to explain these guys, you realize that Justinian just happened to hit upon the stuff about network industries, and he decided that all those things which essentially are networks have to be held in common, and the key feature about a network which is going to be held in common is you're not going to allow anybody to snip it. And so when you start to say, in effect, that these things are inherently public, what you're really saying to the public at large is that we understand that if you allow privatization of this stuff, you will see happen to your rivers what happened to the Rhine River before the Treaty of Westphalia. There'll be a bridge with a toll at every 2 or 3 miles, and the essential value of the system will turn out to be worthless. So what you really do under these circumstances is you now have both sides of this thing being put forward as a matter of natural law, but you can start to see really powerful, fundamental, sort of instrumental justifications that are so strong that there's really nobody except the perverse who would think that the system would work better if, in fact, you started to flip it over. But at this particular point, I said that modernity also makes its claims on you. And so now what you have to do is to start to figure out how robust these systems are as a function of various kinds of social changes. Because it turns out that no matter what system you start to look at, if populations are relatively low, relatively simple property structures will be able to answer the question of how you're going to communicate along a river, just keep the darn thing open. What are you going to do with land? Just let the first possessor take it. But the moment you get to a situation where the intensity of use becomes very heavy, whether you're talking with land or with water or anything else, all of a sudden you start to realize there's serious problems. And with respect to rivers, there are two of them which are quite obvious. Well, one of them turns out to be the fact that you start getting congestion, and then you also have the very serious question about how it is that you maintain this particular river if, in fact, the traffic starts to let it silt up and so forth. Then the question is, how do you take these things into account without altering the fundamental nature of the common property? And what you do is you develop from this very naive sense of Justinian a volume of the world about how it is that you now make property essentially into a common carrier, which, of course, is one of the dominant classes of private property, which is covered maybe 20% of the economy. And one of the great tragedies of a modern legal education is most students will actually graduate and have never studied this particular body of law in a systematic fashion, which it clearly deserves. But sure enough, the trick in all of these situations is to figure out how you could keep the essentially open characteristic of these things while finding ways, A, to have rules of the road and to have a system of public or private finance which will keep these things going forward. So you don't want to allow a river to be closed down in any particular fashion because you have to dredge it and so forth. You want to keep the access. You may have to charge tolls. And out of this common law tradition of open access comes the modern rules called the so-called RAND rules, reasonable and non-discriminatory access, which is essentially designed to figure out how, when you need to make public expenditures, you can still keep the system relatively open as it had been in previously times. The private law seems to understand this pretty well, and you could chase this down from Matthew Hale going through, in effect, Lord Ellenborough, where all the correct principles are announced as early as 1810. The only place where it starts to get screwed up is in modern American constitutional law. And there's a perfectly sound explanation as to why it is they get it wrong. It's because when we do constitutional law for the most part in the United States, it's always with a dismissive sneer with respect to traditional common law or private law conceptions, most of which are not understood by the people who are dismissing them. And so when it came to water, what they said in effect is not when the government makes an improvement does it have to respect all the private rights of individuals along the river, which developed in this very complicated customary web. Instead, what they said is, oh, no, no. If you look at the commerce power, it's not just a power, it gives the government the dominant navigation servitude, and that navigation servitude allows it to wipe out all private rights along the river without compensation. So the failure to understand what's going on means that if you want to build a dam and you flood somebody's land and the riparians lose all their rights, no property rights at all. And you could see it in the nominalism of modern law. Take a very sophisticated opinion by a wonderful justice, Robert Jackson, in the Willow River Creek, the Willow the Willow River case, in which exactly one of these guys is claiming the loss of a mill, of the ability to have the water go down a gradient when they basically change a major river on which he's a tributary. And they say this is too evanescent to be a property right, no kind of protection. So what's so ironic about it is that the constitutional side of this thing is much less sophisticated in the private, in the property rights area than the private side, precisely because it has no knowledge of the tradition from which it goes. And so when you're trying to figure out what the modern applications are of ancient law, what you have to do is to see how you can preserve it through these complexities. And the same thing exists with respect to the first possession rule, because sure enough, when you start going after animals as opposed to land, the common pool and exhaustion problem is extremely severe, and trying to figure out how it is that you alter the system so as to make the yield sustainable becomes a very important task. If you were in the tradition of the common lawyers, you would never be able to say that just wiping out the right to acquire property is something which really doesn't matter. You would have to treat that as a fundamental part of the system, which means that when it comes to design your catch system, you're going to have to try to make a fair allocation of the larger part to those people who had some portion of the original catch by virtue of customary rights and uses. And sure enough, the relentless modernism and its sort of kind of nominalism that takes place is completely insensitive to those kinds of distributional concerns, and it allows you to put all sorts of strange positions, you know, systems into place. And since you don't care about the distributional system, in some cases you could actually net out with certain larger social losses than would otherwise be the case. So just working through the property side, you could see exactly how it is that the transformation of ancient systems still is important. Technically put, what you'd like to do is to have every time you find a technological difficulty, the legal fix that you give to it creates a situation in which previous holdings are fully respected and the gains are divided amongst the previous holders. And that turns out to be, with a little bit of variation, something like a Pareto improvement. So once again, you can see the way in which when you start with natural law, figure out how social changes start to come to bear, what you do in effect is you invoke modern systems of social utility. Our time is obviously running short, so let me just mention very briefly on the contract side and on the tort side the same kind of issues and how it is that they do. First of all, with respect to contract, this is perhaps the easiest place for saying the universality of the principle yields to the particularization of forms in a given society. The basic proposition that you get after you have a system of property rights, the first possession rule, and a system of self-ownership is how, under this world of simple rules, right, you manage to have gains from cooperation. And you need just one principle to do that, which is to say that you encourage cooperation by essentially allowing positive-sum gains to take place through voluntary transactions, and you discourage coercion, which essentially will result in negative-sum gains. So the older version of force and fraud and voluntary arrangement maps perfectly into the modern game theoretical situation as to whether or not games are positive or negative-sum, and you rarely will think of these games as constant-sum because most of the time they're not. You wouldn't incur transactions cost in a private transaction just to leave yourself where you were before. You've got to get the gains out of these things so that, oddly enough, if you understand the way in which the modern economic theory and game theory ties in with the older systems, you can see that these guys intuited all the virtues of positive-sum games and were rightly suspicious of negative-sum games, which drives things in the opposite direction. And so how do you make this thing work? Essentially, to them, the major challenge in the law of contract was not to defend the principle of freedom of contract, which they thought was solidly grounded on natural law principles. It was to make sure that all the frictions associated with the execution of voluntary agreements were, in fact, going to be dealt with by responsible civil institutions. So, you know, you start having recordation. You start having in Roman law stipulation, which is rote repetition of words so that people know that it's a serious bargain, not just simple kind of casual conversation. You end up with the parole evidence rule and so forth. And what Gaius meant when he said that we have these local laws is all of these formalities will vary from place to place for all sorts of good and sufficient reasons, but essentially they all are designed to deal with the same thing. Unless you have a system of formalities that are built in ex ante, you're going to have huge enforcement cost ex post, and that everybody will be the better off if, in fact, you can have clarity of transactions, which formalities themselves are able to supply. Now, the modernists often get this one completely wrong, because what they say is, oh, you've accepted formalism, therefore it means that you believe in regulation. So somehow or other, the fact that you now accept the parole evidence rule means that you have no principled objection to the minimum wage laws, because those are just another form of regulation with respect to voluntary contracts. And that's, again, where the ignorance of the tradition leads to fatal confusions in its understanding. All of the formalities in the earlier systems were designed to expand the level of contractual choices for the parties by allowing them the security of forward transactions at the very low cost of a formality. So if you were to ask any broker, hey, could we improve the system by repealing the statute of frauds, they're going to stick a knife into you because they know their business goes to pieces unless they could rely on the written agreements as being the source of liability and the source of obligation. And the modernists, in effect, they just don't bother to distinguish between regulations that create positive-sum games and those that create negative-sum games. And so they say you concede one, you concede the other. But, of course, a minimum wage law is not designed to improve the enforceability of transactions. It's designed to circumvent and to limit the space for essential gains between the parties. It's a negative-sum type of operation by blocking positive-sum transactions. And so, again, if you understand the way in which the early natural lawyers thought about this subject, you would never make the mistakes which are endemic to the majority of the United States Supreme Court, both of liberal and conservative persuasion, because they, none of them, even the originalists on the Supreme Court, are really steeped in the historical tradition from which all of these originalist doctrines apply. Now, the third thing I'm going to talk about very briefly is the tort law system. And here, of course, it's a slightly different variation. And the first thing to note about the variation with respect to the tort law is that the formality issue simply drops to one side. There is absolutely no way in which you're going to say, oh, in order to make the tort law do well, what we'll do is we'll have a system of formality. So if you want to go kill somebody, you have to sign up on the following bulletin board so that everybody knows what your intentions are. We know, in effect, that we don't want to give formalities with respect to these wrongs, precisely because anything which increases the security of committing wrongs will necessarily decrease the overall level of social welfare. And in fact, very early on, the systems understood that the only time you really are worried about freedom of contract is when the externalities flip over from positive to negative, as they do when you go from a contract to sale of an ordinary good to a contract of a sale of weapon, which is going to be used in order to assassinate or to kill somebody else. And so you get this very coherent doctrine of conspiracy, which essentially flows from understanding that individual wrongs, when aided by gains from trade, are more dangerous, which is why it was that the common lawyers were right when they said, in effect, that conspiracy is not simply an additive offense, it's a multiplicative offense. Two people are more dangerous than one plus one, precisely because of the gains from trade that they achieve at social cost when they combine their own efforts. So you understand why you want the tort law. Interestingly enough, you also understand what the scope of the tort law is going to be. The Romans started this off out with an expression which, in fact, contains more wisdom in two words on proximate cause than you can find in the entire restatement of torts, which is a doctrine which only piles ignorance upon stupidity to the point where nobody can understand what it means. And they said, you want to figure out what the law of torts is about, corpora corpore. Now, what does that phrase mean? It means by the body, to the body. It's essentially the Roman equivalent of the common law of trespass, which says don't punch somebody in the nose. Now, somebody would want to say, well, is that the entire law of torts? And the Romans, of course, were experts in poisoning, and so they could figure out how it is by the body to the body would work if I opened up Nick's throat and rammed some poison down it. But if I was a little bit more guileful and I simply gave Randy a plate of food which was laced with poison so he ate it himself, and that was not by the body to the body, does it mean there was no liability at all? And sure enough, what the really good feature about Roman law was is they understood the power of analogies, how to make it work, and when to quit. And so they developed, after talking about all the force cases, a distinction or a second category of wrong called causam mortis prestare. And what that phrase means, furnishing a cause of death. And again, the secret for understanding the phrase is to take it very literally. I have gone to Randy, I have furnished him with some food, which turns out to be a cause of death. And then we develop from that a much more powerful theory of causation, which says that there are two things that Randy can do which do not sever causal connection. One of them is we could force it down his throat, and the other is we can deceive him. And sure enough, they map in perfectly to the Aristotelian distinctions between actions done under mistake and actions done under duress, neither of which essentially are going to be regarded as fully voluntary, even though they are in some sense volition. And once you start doing the tort law in that fashion and start working out from close cases and go beyond, all of a sudden you realize why it is not only unintelligible, but completely baffling that anybody would have any interest in a set of doctrines which started with the but-for theory of causation to be limited by a theory of proximate cause. The genius of a system of causation that works is you start with close connections and ask yourself at every stage how far you go, and then you have to come up with a test for ending the causal chain, and those turn out to be, if you think about it, amazingly simple. So if I dig a hole and I cover it over with some kind of thatch, so it's a trap and somebody else can fall in, generally that is a live danger, whether you fall in by accident, somebody pushes you in accidentally, somebody pushes you in deliberately. Well, what's going to end the causal chain? It's not the intervention of a deliberate act. It's the fact that somebody fills the darn hole again, so you're back to the original kind of condition. And over again, the Romans get that point right, so that you never have this theory of infinite causation, necessary and sufficient conditions, all the effort to take logical conceptions and to put it into a system of tort law. So what's the moral that you get from understanding these guys? It's that if you really go closely and figure out the way in which these people work their individual cases, instead of finding a kind of conceptual framework, what you can do is make the system more rational and more coherent than they did by simply chipping away at some of their mistakes and making it into a basically coherent system. Whereas try as you might with modern academic theories of causation, like the NES, necessary element of sufficient conditions, you can't do it, because what happens is they're simply barking up the wrong tree by trying to take logical conceptions and use them to describe descriptive connection. So what I've done here is talk only about private law conceptions. And in effect, I haven't talked about defenses and a lot of other stuff which complete the system. But let me suffice it to say that one of the great achievements of the Roman law is they actually knew how to plead a case to joinder of issue and didn't simply say that it was a device for discovery. It was a conceptual way. And so when I was writing this stuff very early on, I would plead cases out to 6 or 7 stages using the Roman methods. And of course, they got it right. And the effort to compress all of this stuff in ways that make it essentially unformally was a mistake. But there's also another benefit that you get from this system, which tells you about how a political system should work. If you put together your public government trying to figure out how it is that you first respect the rights of property, the rights of autonomy, contracts, and understand the enforcement of torts, and then try to create Pareto improvements of that by having such simple things as statutes that are designed to deal with bag limits or statutes of frauds and so forth, essentially what you do is you build off this basic system of rights and constantly improve overall and systematic social welfare. The modern conception of the state is not one which is designed to realize and fulfill natural law ambitions, it's to overturn them. And essentially the single most dangerous element that you have is that saying, oh, once the government gets involved, you don't have to worry about all these limitations. You can now introduce any regime of positive rights that you darn well please. And sure enough, by the time you're done, you'll get womb-to-womb care, of which the latest and most egregious advance of that particular direction was the health care bill. And, you know, what's the root difficulty? It is, in a sense, changing the definition of rights so that the right to health care doesn't mean the right to buy it from somebody who's prepared to supply it to you. It means the right to tax other citizens so that they will take care of your health care, and then we'll turn around and tax you to take care of theirs. And if you go through it all, what we've done is substitute a set of negative sum transactions for a set of positive sum transactions. And so all of the natural law theory turns out to be, when properly understood and explicated, the strongest barrier against what's going on inside the public law space, which is why when I wrote the Takings book, I was so insistent on starting with private property and then figuring out how government could make the system work rather than doing the modern constitutional game, which is to assume that anything under the Constitution is a matter of public law, so that somebody who actually knows something about how private law transactions are put together is suffering from some kind of a pre-political delusion instead of actually understanding the sound principles of statecraft. So I've spoken enough. I'm supposed to end at 7:30 at the very latest. That leaves you no time for questions, of course, which I'm happy to take. But essentially, the lesson is, unless you can master the ancient conceptions of natural law, you will never be able to do modern public policy well. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Questions by anybody? Somebody? Oh, come on. I don't want it to be, I'll debate anybody anytime, but I won't take any questions. What a crowd. Come on. Somebody? I'm feeling embarrassed. Yes, Rogers, thank God. A strong natural law libertarian who worries about my socialist tendencies. This is the man to ask the question. Yes, thank you. This is basically the duty of necessity that falls upon Roger. Okay.
Occurred to me as you were talking about the first quarter of your talk. You spoke, first of all, your talk was not in the normal tradition of natural law talk.
So, obviously. Yes.
That's to your credit, I suppose.
I think so.
But I want to invite you to do this. First of all, say a little more about this move that you made from individual autonomy to natural necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Flags went up.
Yes, I know that.
Yeah, I know. And I wonder if you could expand a little upon that. This notion of natural necessity is a curious notion that I think we need to hear a little bit more about. And I wonder if you would do so in the following context. The distinction between natural law and natural rights is one which gives a lot of people difficulty.
Yeah.
And especially when you go to do the casual street with such issues as, say, homosexuality,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Yeah.
Natural law, people take one tack, natural rights
people take another
tack. And I'm wondering what you have to say about this natural necessity, the natural rights versus natural law in the context of this specific example.
All right. Thank you, Roger, for making me miss my plane. But you're actually asking two questions which are completely different and both are perfectly relevant and correct, I think. If you'll remember when I started to talk about the natural necessity stuff, I said there's some people who tend to treat individual autonomy as something which they regard as kind of a historical and evidentiary truth, and there are others who sort of believe it as something which is close to natural necessity so that you can only deny it on fear of self-contradiction. And, you know, if you go back and you start to look at the justifications for the autonomy principle, particularly in Locke, what you do is you find out that he does very badly with respect to it, because he says that a man's person is something which we rightly can say will be his. And it's an extremely powerful sentence because everybody kind of agrees with it in terms of its conclusion, but people are very upset about the fact that there's no justificatory status that does it. And so one of the ways in which people try to do this is to say, look, you look around anywhere every time, you do see slavery and nobody defends it. So it's quite clear that the common consent of mankind is behind some version of the autonomy principle, because every time that it turns out to be violated, we attack it. And then when you get into modern times, you could even strengthen that argument by giving the historical evolution of personhood, which in Roman law was an extremely complicated body of law. And as you go forward starting in the 18th century and to go forward, essentially personhood is designed to say that every natural person has full legal rights. And so you transform slavery, you transform infants, not infancy, but people who are in the power of their parents after their majority, you transfer the sex differences and all the rest of that stuff. And so you get that historical stuff. Then you get the people like Strauss and so forth, who just hate contingent explanations because they think that you can start to deny them without fear of self-contradiction, and they want to ground the basic principle of, they think, of human dignity in something which is stronger than this sort of cultural commonality. And so they are the ones who start picking up the necessity language, and the reason why you said that's a kind of an illicit move is that necessity in this sense does not mean logical necessity where you deny it on contradiction. It starts to have a more Kantian flair where it sounds like something like the synthetic a priori, a posteriori, right? The sort of things which have to happen to be true but aren't necessarily true, and nobody understands what that is. I mean, there's that long battle between Hume, who denied any such relationship, and Kant, who tried to resurrect them, and you kind of fight this one to a philosophical draw. So now how would I come out on this? Well, essentially, you know, my view about social welfare is heavily influenced by some of the work that Ronald Coase had done. As I mentioned to some of the students at dinner tonight, that Ronald Coase is the economist who discovered friction. And it turns out friction or transactions costs are inherent everywhere else. And so you just apply to individual autonomy the same kind of arguments that Ronald applied to any other property rights. In a system in which there is zero transactions cost, what will happen is if individual autonomy, which gives you complete control over your body and me complete control over my body, is the optimal situation, we will get there through an infinite number of transactions that take place in a zero amount of time. And that's why it is that the whole zero transactions cost world is so grotesque, because it presupposes essentially that there are no obstacles to infinite equilibration. And in fact, time doesn't mean anything at all. And what really happens is, as Ronald said, go to the second half of the argument, positive transactions cost. And the thing that we note is that there's no way that any one individual can make contracts with all individuals to deal with something like autonomy in a state of nature. And the explanation is really powerful, and it explains also the origins of property and the concerns about coercion and force, which is, in order for the autonomy claim to be good, as a contractual situation, you have to be able to do a separate peace with everybody. If one person stays out of this particular arrangement, he could stab you in the dark of night and you'll never be able to sleep. And in fact, if you take the most dangerous person and buy him off with perfect enforcement, the second worst person will do that. So the argument in favor of individual autonomy is, as a moral vision, you'll look around and you try to think of any end state which you would prefer to the one which says that each person has equal liberty and exclusive control over his own person, subject to the mutual renunciation of force. And you ask yourself, can you find something that generalizes which is better than that? And it turns out you can't. And it's as powerful as the distinction of why it is that rivers are common and private property, your houses are private property, and so forth. So you'll look at both parts of this thing. The first thing is, do you want to get rid of the equality constraint that I've just given, sort of equal liberty? Well, if you get rid of it, you're going to have to explain what the differentials are across not only two people, which you can do in contract, but across every person on the state of the globe. And you're going to have some metric on entitlements which will tell you which get preferences by how much over everybody else. And you have to keep consistent transitivities. You can't at all do that. So you don't want to get rid of the equality stuff. Then, in effect, well, what about the liberty stuff on non-interference? The great advantage of liberty in this situation, it's a technical matter, is it's the only configuration of rights amongst people which is perfectly scalable, independent of wealth. And what do I mean by that? Generally speaking, when you start talking about families, you can have all sorts of ad hoc arrangements between husband and wife and three children. You get two sets of families and put them together in the same household, not going to work so good, right? So informal, dense network relationships are not scalable above a very, very small amount. And indeed, the moment you get it large, you introduce another kid into the family, everything else has to be recalibrated. But non-interference from the use of force is, in fact, perfectly scalable, and you could do it in a small society of 1,000 or in a large one of 1 billion. And, in fact, it's durable in another regard because it's scalable with respect to wealth changes, unlike positive rights, where you never know how much you could give so much until you know how much you could produce. So you put all of this stuff together, and the way you come out to it is, in a positive transactions cost world, you end up with the autonomy as the desired state. Because in a world where you can't have individual transactions, having gone through the mental calculus, you're quite confident that this would turn out to be the focal solution for just about anyone, anywhere, at any time. And so if, in fact, you get that kind of inevitability using this analysis, all of a sudden, the kind of natural necessity language takes on a third meaning. And what that third meaning turns out to be is it's the equilibrium point that fully informed people would reach if their transactions cost was zero, and you're so confident about it that this distribution has a single peak and there's nothing around it. And in the end, I think that's why, if you look at it, the common custom and the natural necessity people, they all point you in the same directions for different reasons. I think the explanation that I've given is actually better, and I'm going to tell the same story I told at lunch or at dinner to some of the students when we had it before. I was trying to explain this, or some version of this, years ago to an English professor from a place called Wofford College, and old George Martin was a libertarian, later president of the Liberty Fund, if you happen to remember. And he listens to me going on for about 20 minutes, getting myself into high dungeon and spirits, and then he just stops me, and this is what he said. He says, "Richard, I've listened to you now for about 30 minutes, and I think I've understood some of what you said, but not all of it. But I can tell you one thing for sure, is that if I took a transcript or a tape of this conversation, I could get you civilly committed in any state in the Union." That's what he said. Now, why? Now, this was actually a really, it was a good solid body blow because it explains what the real difficulty is. I was giving these explanations to defend perfectly homespun arguments, which everybody accepts intuitively, in a formal way. And to most people, the intuition is much more comfortable than the explanation. So one of the great difficulties that sort of moral theorists who come out of the consequential tradition, as I do, is to always be able to link up what we're saying by way of proof for what other people ordinarily believe. And we have to ourselves check our own intuitions against, in fact, their intuitions, and then have to try, if you could get them to sit down long enough to listen to you, explain why it is that what you're doing is really just making more formal what they've done. And I think, in effect, that it is ultimately the right explanation, which explains, to quote you again, why it is this is such an unconventional view of natural lawyers, because most of the natural lawyers who defended this stuff have no idea of the apparatus that I'm bringing to bear upon it, so the language that I'm using is as alien to them as it is to the ordinary man in the street. Now, the other question you ask about natural law and natural right with respect to gay marriage is, in fact, a very different type situation. And essentially, the modern interpretation of this, or explication of this, has to do with the scope of the morals power of the police power. And if you go back and you read all of the traditional views on individual liberty, what you see in the late 19th century is a very incautious but instructive list, which says that you could limit the individual liberties of ordinary people or the way in which they use or dispose of their private property to deal with the health, safety, general welfare, or morals. And every one of these terms is contested in some important dimension. But the one morals is, I think, most instructive for these purposes. If you were taking sort of the traditional view of, you know, sort of what natural law requires as consistent with ordinary human beings, and not being so much a libertarian, but rather being somebody who's sort of looking at accepted social mores and so forth, you would tap in modern terms, to the very powerful intuitions that people have about the so-called disgust norms. In fact, there's some very good work about this by a man named Jonathan Haidt at the University of Virginia, who says basically people's all intuitions always precede their judgments. That is, they rationalize what they feel. And that they have three sets of instincts. One of the instincts is reciprocate, which is contract. Another is keep your hands to yourself, which is tort. And the third is to be aware of disgust. And that deals with such things as adultery, sodomy, prostitution, homosexuality, polygamy, masturbation. You name it, it deals with it, right? And it turns out the dominant kinds of intuitions that people have are not libertarian, precisely because anything which is sexual is close to something which is familial, and anything which is familial is organized on deep concepts of interactions which are not part of this libertarian world that you have. Keep everybody at the arm's length, have strong property rights, and do it. So historically, there's no question that if you go about this, the 19th century decisions that tapped into this morals tradition were very consistent with a large amount of Western civilization. What is interesting is the Supreme Court, which doesn't believe that two people are allowed to work one for another at a wage of $5 an hour, all of a sudden believe that homosexual sodomy and everything else is absolutely the single most important feature on life. And you can see it, because if you go back to the 19th century versions, when they talked about homosexuality, it was a meretricious relationship. I had to go to the dictionary the first time I read it to figure out what this denunciation meant. And now when you read Lawrence against Texas, it all of a sudden becomes a transcendental experience, right? Well, what you've done is you've kept the vector very large, but you just changed the sign from positive to negative. And so the battle you therefore get, and it's a deep one, is between those people whose views of natural law as being conservative means, in effect, that they believe the kinds of practices that kept us alive traditionally, the ones that we follow today, in con law tradition, that's Stephen Calabresi, accurate reading, in my judgment, of privileges or immunities in the 14th Amendment as referring only to traditional liberties of which homosexual sodomy was not one, and so it's not covered. And then the modern ones are pure libertarians on this dimension, but on no others. And they say, you don't like it, you take offense about it, squat, just don't watch it. Or as Bonnie Frank said, very tellingly, you don't like gay marriage, don't attend the wedding, right? I mean, and at that particular point, they then say, well, marriage licenses, we're in favor of marriage, but what's this license business? And all of a sudden, the same people are saying, well, if you're going to grant marriage license to heterosexual couples, the licensing power is a monopoly power of the state, they have to have non-discriminatory rules, there's no rational distinction between them and gay couples, and so therefore you got to grant it to both. Essentially, what these guys do is they become perfectly consistent libertarians within a narrow space. And that's a profound difference. And if you realize that the autonomy principle is both supportive of and has been limited by these moral cases, you can see why there will be blood on the floor for a long time to go. Now, what's my view about this issue, Roger asked, and I will state it in a sentence. I think the constitutional cases has to respect the history, even though there's no text, because remember, there's nothing about the police power that's written into the Constitution. And on the other hand, if you ask me how I think what you have to do is to say, even if you find this stuff squeamish and so forth, as a social matter, the decent and proper thing to do is not to allow your sense of offense to block the way in which other people live their lives. So I become a constitutional conservative and a political liberal. And I regard the first as being accurate to the constitutional tradition, and the second being more consistent with my libertarian instincts. And by the way, a classical liberal should have exactly the same attitude on this. The areas where they differ from libertarians are such things as eminent domain and taxing powers and, you know, rate regulation and so forth. But on individual bilateral transactions, the two theories collapse into one another. So that's the answer to that question. Is there one other question? That was 15 minutes. I'm quite happy to stop and let you all get a drink. But I don't want you to feel intimidated, for Christ's sake. I don't know anything about this. Another question? Come on. Somebody. Going once? I feel like an auction. Ah, yes, thank you. Get to that microphone and sing.
Natural law as applied to humans. You said it has an aspect that's evolutionary, that we will look at the rules that developed from the time immemorial and even before 10,000 years of our evolution that kept us alive, made us alive, to the extent that it applies to animals as it does to us. We can look at that. And one might look at homosexuality as being unnatural in that sense, because there's no evolutionary explanation. Just to throw one example, there could be many.
Yeah.
And my question is, as somebody who thinks somewhat, has finds some appeal in natural law, is that it is, when we say natural law, we look at human nature as being perhaps distinct from animal nature, that we are different, and that therefore what is natural for us might be quite different from even our, we might have a natural right, a tendency to transcend our evolutionary past. I mean, not completely. We can't just, you know, become disembodied, you know, angels or something like that. But in some ways, we really aren't animals. We are different, and we have a human nature that is not animalistic and therefore could arguably not be bound by all of that evolutionary stuff that came before, even if there are some strong tendencies that we may want to overcome those things.
And that I don't think that's the way the natural lawyers thought of it. I think they're actually, in this case, a little bit more subtle, and I think actually more correct than that account, which is they said, look, you put on a cerebrum on top of a cerebellum, you still got a cerebellum. So human beings are going to have certain types of situations where their limbic system will take over and their cognitive system will disappear. My favorite illustration of that is a little scene in the movie called The Culpeper Cattle Company. Did anyone ever see this great movie? It's about a thing, and what they do is they have a rattlesnake in a jar, okay? And what they do is they provoke the rattlesnake, and he starts to try to bite you, and the glass obviously stops. The question is whether or not you could put your hand on the jar and keep it there with full knowledge of the fact that the rattlesnake will come at you and it can't reach you. How many people do you think could keep it there?
Zero.
Well, why is that? Because your cognitive system, in the face of what is perceived as imminent peril, shuts off. All this stuff starts to take over. So you're like a rat when you're trapped under these circumstances. They turn off the top and they go down. So you can't get rid of the bottom stuff. And you don't want to say, to give a homie an animal, because you now could build two stories up, you can ignore everything in the foundation. You got to deal with the brain that both part. And so the traditional natural lawyers, they sort of understood these aggressive tendencies, these intuitive tendencies, the importance of mating, raising children, and so forth. And they said, hey, you know, we can think. So if you're talking about animals, their capacity to make forward-looking contracts are going to be limited because they can't have form and so forth. Well, we like forward-looking contracts. We're not animals. We'll have a statute of fraud. Then you look back at animals, and you know what you discover? They can, after a fashion, make forward-looking contracts, just in a very limited nature. So if you study the way in which troops of baboons work, and you sort of male and females together, and access to females, and alpha males, and double males, what you do is you see these kind of loose coalitions and alliances taking place, in which there's mutual aid and support, and then, of course, you can get toppled when the alpha male gets a little bit too old, and one of the other guys goes in revolution. So what you find out is that virtually everything people can do, animals can do worse, and the... or better. I mean, you know, certain instincts. I mean, they're better hunters in many ways because they're not clouded over by doubt in the way in which
they don't have pockets.
Yeah, and they don't have pockets or whatever it is. But you know, they have other. So you then start figuring out a natural law theory says, okay, we add cognition, we add moral awareness, and we start to add on language and so forth, and now we're a little bit different. This actually has become a very important battle when you started to talk about animal rights. This was a very big issue 10 years ago. And let me just tell you a little story, and then we will stop for real. Is I was sitting in my office one day when I get a phone call by a guy named Bill Glaberson, who is a reporter for the New York Times. And, you know, consistent with other things, he says, I understand you're an authority on animal rights. I said, I don't know what that subject is. I said, animal rights. There's this guy, you know, and then he started to talk about a couple of people, Stephen Wise in particular, who were very strong animal rights guys, and they had announced that I was an authority on the other side. I said, okay, let's just talk about animal rights. I said, and I did it. I said, look, I could tell you a lot about animal law because I remember I'm a Roman lawyer by training, and the thing you have to understand is that animals were a much more important capital asset then than they are now, so huge portions of their law are devoted to understanding how you start dealing with animals. And so I start explaining to him how the law is organized and so forth. And, you know, we go on this, and he's looking into the telephone in a very weird way, but kind of mildly interested in what's happening. And then I said, look, and there's a serious problem that these characters start to have when they start saying this with animal law. How far do they want to take this thing? I said, do you want to treat bacteria as animals? And then I said, you know, there's another problem, which is if you try to superimpose today's modern norms about animals on earlier society, you'd never have broken the sod, and we would still be back in primitive position. And then I talked about a bunch of other things having to do with vicarious liability and the conveyance of animals and so forth. That didn't interest him. So this thing goes out in the paper, and Glaberson has the story, and they cut it so that my name is on the front page of the story as being the opponent of animal rights who made these two objections. And I'm off in Charlotte doing some antitrust case. And I get on my voicemail, this is 1998, and I turn it on and there are 19 messages. I said, I don't have 19 friends. What the hell is going on? Well, 16 of them were from people on various things. We understand you're the leading opponent of natural animal rights in the United States. We would like you to be on MSNBC, this, that, and the other thing. And so I start going on these shows, right? Because now at this time I had an extra hour. I said, hey, you know, this really is crazy stuff. And, you know, animals voting and all the rest of this stuff, animal territory, first possession rule, you know, which of the rules do you keep, which of them do you not? And so I do this. It ends up, I actually go on National Geographic and have a debate with Stephen Wise. I mean, I became a real celebrity in this thing for about 4 or 5 years before essentially it went the way of all lamb chops and people just got tired of the issue and it sort of disappeared. So I became this expert. But the one argument that really drew blood with other people is they wanted to say, you know, these animals really should be treated with respect to human beings. And so I said to them, well, let's see what we can do about this. Because we believe in the principle of autonomy, right? You won't let a wild animal kill. Why don't you find a lion out there and explain to him that it's not a good thing to eat a chimpanzee? And see if you could get it in the wild to listen to your injunctions. And so they look at you and they say, you're crazy, Professor Epstein. Everybody knows they have no moral sense. I said, well, that was exactly my point, right? And so what you did is you really could see the differences between animals and human beings when you looked at animal-animal interactions. So Stephen Wise, for example, only really cares about chimpanzees for the obvious similarities. And so you look around and you find the typical account of a chimpanzee going up a tree and dismembering a monkey and eating it. So I said, Stephen, are you going to tell this guy it's the wrong thing to do? And he says, well, I might, but first you have to prove to me that monkeys are sensate individuals. You know, and yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just, that's what happens to the moral argument. You start having these kind of factual denials of these things. But the basic point sort of remains true, is that the kinds of codes that you can teach and impress upon your children, it's beyond the capacity of animals to learn. The only thing they have by nature is a caution and respect with respect to conspecifics, and even that, of course, if you read the chimpanzee wars and so forth, is quite imperfect. It tends to be clan as much as animal loyalty and a certain kind of brutality associated with them. But it's an inbred morality that you cannot change. You actually look at the modern sociobiological and neurological literature that's coming up, more and more of it turns out to be pre-programmed. in terms of the eyes of many people, in terms of the way in which people interact, why they're successful, why they're happy. I mean, there was something just yesterday in the paper about why people believe in religion, because it actuates certain hormones that make them, you know, sort of be at rest one way or another. I think a lot of that stuff is actually really quite true. And so the kind of true story is, you know, we have this superstructure. And that may mean that we have a 10-story building, but it's not just that the foundation is based upon these natural instincts, but even as you go up the levels, there's always going to be some influence, so that what happens is, as you start at the base, it's heavily naturalistic. As you move up, it becomes less so, but never does it become entirely cognitive. And if only if you get that kind of view of what human nature is like, that you'll understand, I think, how you want to put these kinds of rules together. And you'll also understand why it is that everybody who has a totalitarian instinct, their first desire in life is to break down people's natural moral sensitivities by extreme deprivations in order to remold them. So essentially, if you're not a totalitarian, you sort of have to live with the imperfect nature of human beings. I think we should have a drink. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. My name's Eka Apakip, and I'm the president of the Georgetown Federal Society for this year. And I think it's clear from Professor Epstein's remarks and from the introductory remarks from Professor Rosenkranz and Professor Barnett that Professor Epstein has had a great influence on Federalist thought and ideals. And I'm very proud to present him with the 7th Annual Lifetime Service Award.
Well, thank you. Now, can I ask you for a favor? Could you mail this to me?
Yes, we will.
I am now going to return the award. But I want you to know that the nature of the transaction is determined by its intention. This is basically a bailment, not a refusal.